It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
The Ebola death toll approaches 2,000 as UN warns of virus's high cost to contain it. New outbreaks of the disease feared in Guinea and Nigeria. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The World Health Organization has revised the fatalities of the latest Ebola outbreak in West Africa up sharply, warning a global response to the virus will be costly. Margaret Chan, Director General of the Global Health Body, Wednesday said the outbreak has so far killed more than 1,900 people and infected at least 3,500.
It has become a global threat, and we require urgent action, and we need a well-coordinated mechanism bringing together the countries affected, as well as development partners from other countries, including USA. Now that I'm in US, I want to tell you the US government has been a very strong supporter through many agencies like the CDC, NIH, and of course, USAID and others.
The UN's system coordinator on Ebola, Dr. David DeBarro, at the same Washington News Conference, warned the fight against the disease will cost upwards of $600 million. Last week, the WHO warned the disease could affect 20,000 people in as many as 10 countries. The UN agency says a Nigerian doctor who died from the illness exposed dozens of other people in the Port Harcourt area that he treated after becoming infected. Some 60 people are now said to be under surveillance. One person Wednesday died at a Port Harcourt isolation center, becoming the seventh fatality from Ebola in Nigeria. In Guinea, where the outbreak was first detected in February, announced 9 new cases in the country's southeast. President Alpha Conde has urged healthcare workers to step up efforts to avoid new infections. This is VOA News. In the United States, the third American missionary who served in Liberia and became infected with Ebola has been identified. Bruce Johnson heads the SIM International Mission.
Well, as we learned yesterday, one of our SIM missionary doctors in Liberia tested positive to Ebola. That doctor is Dr. Rick Sacra.
The obstetrician is the third missionary serving with SIM in Liberia to contract Ebola. The other two, Dr. Ken Brantley and Nancy Wrightbull, were transported back to the United States for treatment and have since recovered. The Somali government Wednesday offered an amnesty to Al-Shabaab fighters who give themselves up within 45 days. The offer follows Monday's U.S. drone strike that targeted the militant group's leader, Ahmed Abdi Ghoddani, whose fate remains unclear. As Abdulaziz Billah reports from Mogadishu, the Somali government welcomed that U.S. attack.
Government spokesman Ridwan Haji Abdiweli told reporters that the government supports any operations against the militant group. He said the target of this operation were the key commanders of the Al-Shabaab. Such attacks will continue, he said, because it's only the Somali government that has the authority to govern this nation and not terrorist groups like the Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab has neither confirmed nor denied reports that its top leader, Abdi Ahmed Ghoddani, was killed in the attack. If confirmed, his death will be a serious setback for Al-Shabaab. At least 6 people were reportedly killed in the drone strike, which took place in Sablale, an agricultural town in southern Somalia. The town is 60 kilometers from Barawe, the last remaining Al-Shabaab bastion in southern Somalia and a key port for the group. Abdulaziz Bilon for VOA. Mogadishu.
Lesotho's Prime Minister Thomas Tabane has returned to the capital, Maseru, 4 days after he fled to South Africa after an apparent bid by the military to oust him. He was guarded by South African police. He fled Saturday before the military surrounded his residence and that of a top police official and disarmed 2 police stations in the capital. He accused the army and Deputy Prime Minister Mothajoa Metsing of seeking to oust him. The military denied to staging a coup and accused elements of the police force of planning to arm political radicals ahead of a anti-government protest last Monday. In Central African Republic, the French press agency says 5 people were killed Wednesday during an attack by armed men said to be part of the mainly Muslim Salika rebel alliance in the northern town of Nana Bakassa. A 2-month-old ceasefire agreement has failed to end sectarian violence. According to the multinational professional service group PricewaterhouseCoopers, Africa's energy industry could boom in coming years, with Mozambique and Tanzania set to emerge as new frontiers with the right amount of foreign investment. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 4th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The World Health Organization calls for a coordinated response to fight Ebola.
We are seeking to ensure that all governments, professional groups with an interest and an involvement, not just in public health, but in the security of our world, own this issue as their problem.
David Nambaro is the UN System Coordinator for Ebola. Nigeria's oil-rich River State is training medical staff to deal with any potential Ebola cases. Zimbabwe's former prime minister discusses his party's upcoming convention, and the African Union mission in Mali sees improvement in security.
What one can say is that so long as these groups are at the negotiating table, there is some commitment until we can see in reality that some aren't committed to this process.
Isaka Suare is the special advisor to the head of the African Union mission in Mali. Somalis in Minnesota are shocked that some of their members are linked to the Islamic State known as ISIS, and a global diabetes epidemic hampers tuberculosis control. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An aid agency on the ground in West Africa and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control say there is a narrow window of opportunity to control the Ebola outbreak. Meanwhile, top officials from the World Health Organization visited New York and Washington on Wednesday to appeal for more funding to help bring the Ebola outbreak under control. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
The Ebola virus is raging in three West African countries and has affected people in three more. Wednesday, the World Health Organization upped the number of lives the disease has claimed to more than 1,900. But experts say no one really knows how many people have gotten ill and how many may have died from the virus. The WHO estimates that getting the virus under control will cost $500 million. The health organization has introduced a plan it calls a roadmap for stopping the spread of Ebola. Dr. Margaret Chan says the proposed roadmap has wide support from countries and institutions throughout Africa, and that many developed countries have responded as well.
This is an international issue, a global threat, and that requires global coordination to get it done.
Doctors David Navarro, the United Nations coordinator for Ebola, and Keiji Fukuda, the WHO Assistant Director General, joined Dr. Chan in her appeal. They spoke about the country's major needs. They include getting air travel reinstated so health workers and goods can get through, guaranteeing payment for doctors and other healthcare workers, providing food and cooking fuel as prices for both have skyrocketed, and providing for those who have lost jobs because of the epidemic. They also called for more treatment centers, the reopening of regular hospitals, support to help countries get bodies off the streets faster, dignified burials, and more public education about the very real dangers of untreated Ebola. Dr. Navarro stressed the need for leadership and international coordination.
Those of us who've worked in complex situations know that coordination saves lives and improves efficiency. We are not in a position where we can afford to lose a day because this outbreak is currently moving ahead of efforts to control it.
Dr. Chan mentioned that scientists at WHO headquarters in Geneva will evaluate the most promising experimental therapies that could be fast-tracked to help contain the outbreak.
We can and we will bring the Ebola epidemic under control.
Doctors Without Borders first called for urgent action on the Ebola crisis in March. Tuesday, the organization criticized the World Health Organization for not acting sooner to bring it under control. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
In Nigeria, oil-rich Rivers State is training medical staff to handle any potential cases of the deadly Ebola virus. Two people are reportedly being held at the quarantine and treatment center. One has the virus and the other is under surveillance. They had been in contact with a Port Harcourt doctor who treated an ECOWAS official for Ebola. Health officials now say they are working to improve their ability to track and treat anyone who might have been exposed to the virus. Samson Parker is the River State Commissioner for Health. He explains to reporter Tony Tamunu some of the preparations his state is making.
Right now, we have a combined team of the River State and the federal team on ground now. And we have mobilized men and resources to the field with a treatment and quarantine center. And we are reaching out to all nooks and crannies where contacts may be to isolate and observe them. Already we have observed that the wife of the victim, the deceased, is symptomatic and she's now been evacuated for treatment.
Also like to know how many health clinics will be poorly equipped with trained personnel to handle this epidemic in the state?
Right now, almost all the private hospitals are being trained. The primary health center staff are being trained. The hospital staff, we have a large pool that are being trained in batches. So most, we want to get all our staff to be ready, at least identify the illness on time and take necessary steps.
Do you have airports and other ports in the state that you are monitoring for this Ebola virus?
Yes, the State Stakeholders Committee has the Port Health Department of the Federal Ministry of Transport as part of, and they are doing their utmost best to monitor all entry ports, airports, and seaports. We have about three seaports and one airport, international airport, maybe two, and one local airport in Port Harcourt, and all those centers the Port Health Authority are taking care of.
Is River State Government undertaking a public education, that is sensitization awareness campaign? If you're doing so, have you reached out to chiefs in the rural areas and stakeholders and opinion leaders?
All stakeholders are being reached now by the Social Mobilization Committee, and they are going around. Just today, I just spoke with the church leaders, all the communities, the primary health care, medical officers of health, and the DSNOs in the various local government areas are doing the same. The Primary Health Care Board is carrying on sensitization in all the 23 local government areas.
Are there specific traditions that will lead to infection, like washing or treating of dead bodies? Have you taken care of that?
We continue to educate people on handling dead bodies. That is, first, advocating for reporting of all cases of death to the Ministry of Health. And there are restrictions of movement of corpses now without clearance from the Ministry of Health. And without a death certificate and cause of death, morticians are not allowed to receive bodies anymore. And we are continuing to sensitize the public on this.
That was Dr. Samson Parker, River State Commissioner for Health. He was speaking with reporter Tony Tamuno in Port Harcourt, Nigeria. The African Union's mission to Mali and the Sahel says the situation in the north of the country appears to be calm following a resumption of the second round of peace negotiations between the government in Bamako and rebel groups this week in neighboring Algeria. Isaka Suare, special advisor to AU mission head Pierre Buyoya, says the parties at the peace talks seem to be committed to ending the conflict in Mali's north.
We are aware of some intercommunal violence and even inter-movement confrontation, but that was about a week ago. Since the beginning of this week, we have not received any information about such confrontations going on the ground. It is normal that negotiators, I mean the parties that are in the process for negotiation, try to aim high so that they would get to an acceptable level of their requests or what they are calling for. So I think it's premature to judge at this stage.
Since the first round of peace talks, what has been the situation in northern Mali, especially in areas where confrontations, violence, and attack of civilians were rampant?
Well, what we are seeing in the public pronouncements of the various parties at the negotiating table is that they're all committed to finding a a peaceful resolution to this conflict. We are aware of the fact that while the first round of the talks, that is from early July to the end of the month, were going on, that there was some confrontation between some groups on the ground, particularly in the Tabankor area in Gao. And that is why, alongside the roadmap that was signed on the 24th of July, there was a cessation of hostilities declaration that was also adopted, and it was aimed specifically at that particular situation. What one can say is that so long as these groups are at the negotiating table, that there is some commitment until we can see in reality that some are not committed to this process.
Now, how optimistic is the AU about the prospect of these peace negotiations, especially when the AU has a seat at the negotiating table between the government and the rebel groups?
We are very optimistic. We are very optimistic. As I said, you have the groups that are committed to the negotiating tables, and none has so far said that they are not taking part in the process. In fact, a development that occurred last week was that a number of armed groups got together in Ouagadougou to try.
Former Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, who is also leader of the opposition movement for democratic change, is accusing President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party of sabotaging his party's operations by failing to release funds that it is entitled to under the country's Political Finance Act. The act stipulates that a party that garners at least 5% of the vote in a previous election is eligible to receive public funds. Mr. Tsvangirai's party is now struggling to raise enough money for its Congress, which is set for Harare beginning October 30th. Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe Service spoke with Mr. Tsvangirai about the country's economic problems.
This is fiction. Every time we go to a Congress, as we are preparing for the October Congress, structures are given an opportunity to look at the Constitution with the intention of reviewing whatever section needs amendment given our experience. So the process which is taking place is a grassroots-based process. The people are giving inputs to the committee or to the commission that we have set up. The commission or the committee has not even reported to the organs of the party. Once they are through, they will come to the executive, who will examine the report, and will send it back to the structures to verify their input before we send it to the National Council and then before we submit it to Congress. So that process is still ongoing. There is no such thing that I want to manipulate the people. After all, I've spent the rest of the almost 35 years of my life in the trade unions and in the party fighting against dictatorship.
Some of your top lieutenants are alleging that there are some people who are actually using your name to say this is what Mr. Tsvangirai wants, and therefore it must be done when it comes to constitutional reforms.
Yeah, well, I don't want people who go around masquerading as spokesperson for the president. The president does not change the constitution. The committee does not change the constitution. The committee receives inputs from provinces and from grassroots as to what constitutional amendments are needed. Given our history, we have to deal with a lot of things.
But you have personally previously expressed a personal desire to have the constitution amended. Is this not where maybe this talk about you wanting more power is coming from?
Mm-hmm. Suppose Tsvangirai tomorrow is found dead. What does that got to do with my desires? Constitutions are meant to deal with the dangers of the future, not with the angels of today. And I've said, yes, we need to relook at our constitution given our experiences. And as far as my expressions were concerned, I never directed anyone to change anything other than the people making suggestions what changes are necessary.
Talking about resources, have you raised enough money to hold a successful Congress?
No, we haven't. But we are trying to adjust to give the priorities to transport, accommodation, and party organization Congress that will be taking place.
That was former Zimbabwe Prime Minister and leader of the opposition MDC, Morgan Tsvangirai, speaking with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America, and I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 4th. the death of American citizen Douglas MacArthur McCain while fighting for the Islamic State known as ISIS in Syria has raised concerns about the radicalization and recruitment of young men from immigrant communities throughout the United States. As viewers Kane Fairbowl reports, the large Somali American community in the northern state of Minnesota is coming to terms with news that one of its own may be the second American to die with a terror group.
It is difficult for Goth Ali to believe the man in these shaky and grainy social media videos is the same man he met almost a decade ago, Abdirahman Muhammad.
And one of my friends, he told me, hey, Abdirahman is fighting for the Saudi, you know. I said, what? I thought he's going to Ethiopia and fighting. I was shocked, actually.
Ali says the father of nine left his family behind. And according to posts on his Facebook page that Ali believes are Muhammad's, he resurfaced earlier this year in the Middle East, brandishing weapons and calling for others to join him in jihad. Minnesota Public Radio profiled Muhammad in a June report and through a series of Facebook messages with the radio station, confirmed he was fighting with Islamic State, also known as ISIS. Ali almost doesn't recognize his friend.
But we used to hang out, me and him, and going out and sometimes, you know, play ball.
Another Somali American from Minnesota, Abdi Mohammed Noor, is believed to be fighting in Syria. His sister Ifra told VOA earlier this year, Noor sent her a text message indicating he planned to join the jihad. Muhammad and Noor are among a number of ethnic Somali men from Minnesota believed to have left to join the conflict in Syria and Iraq, countries where they don't typically have family connections. The men are believed to be part of a larger investigation by the FBI's field office in Minneapolis. Supervisory Special Agent E.K. Wilson did not talk about specific cases, but addressed the overall problem.
It's a significant concern of ours. It's a very high priority.
Wilson says the internet has become one of the key recruiting tools for terror groups.
It has made the radicalization process change over time. It's created the opportunities, or more opportunities, I should say, for self-radicalization.
Ali and others in the Somali community agree.
I don't believe there's recruiting going on in Minneapolis or somewhere else in Minnesota or somewhere in the United States. Actually, the recruit, what I feel is recruit is coming from YouTube.
The FBI is highlighting the message that joining an armed conflict overseas may be illegal and potentially deadly. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, St. Paul, Minnesota.
The growing number of type 2 diabetes cases worldwide will make it difficult to control and eliminate tuberculosis. As VOA's Jessica Berman reports, experts have found a connection between the two diseases reminiscent of HIV and TB.
For reasons that are still unclear, type 2 diabetes increases the risk of developing tuberculosis. In a series of articles in the journal The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology, researchers report that 15% of adult TB cases worldwide are due to diabetes, translating to more than 1 million infections. More than 40% of diabetes-associated TB cases are in India. Reynold Van Cravel is a researcher and professor of international health at Nijmegen Medical Center in the Netherlands. He says diabetes triples the chances of developing tuberculosis. With diabetes reaching epidemic proportions, Van Cravel says that will make TB control efforts increasingly difficult.
There's now 380 million diabetes patients worldwide. 20 years from now, it will be 580 million, and this increase is especially taking place in Africa, where the incidence of TB is the highest.
Van Cravel likens the relationship between diabetes and TB to that of HIV and tuberculosis. Having one disease increases the risk of acquiring the second. With HIV, a severely compromised immune system sets the stage for an active TB infection. With diabetes, the cause of the increased risk is less clear. Von Cravel suggests something is happening metabolically in those with type 2 diabetes that makes them vulnerable to tuberculosis. Once infected with TB, diabetics are also much harder to treat, according to Von Cravel.
TB treatment, there's more failures, there's more relapses, there's more toxicity, when the patient is also suffering from diabetes. So for the individual patient, there's issues when these two diseases come together, just like the same is true for HIV and TB, let's say.
But the news is not all bad. Experts report public health efforts to help patients prevent and control diabetes with good diet and exercise could potentially reduce the number of TB cases by 15% or more by 2035 over current expected reductions in the tuberculosis rate. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Nigeria risks being suspended from international football if the recently crowned Nigeria Football Federation head, Christopher Giwa, does not step down from office by the 8th of September, FIFA disclosed in Zurich, Switzerland on Wednesday. According to FIFA, Giwa took power at the helm of Nigerian football on 26th of August in circumstances that violate the NFF and FIFA statutes. FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valks clarified that they recognize the NFF board headed by Aminu Maigari as it stood on the 25th of August. FIFA expects that board to be reinstated so that they convene an extraordinary general assembly to elect members of their electoral committee. A second extraordinary general assembly should soon follow to elect a new NFF board. FIFA made it plain that failure to follow this roadmap will see Nigeria ostracized from international football. The immediate casualties of that sanction will be the African champions Nigeria Super Eagles, who start their qualifying campaign for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations this coming weekend. Nigeria Super Falcons will also miss the Africa Women's Championships due in Windhoek, Namibia next month. With that, the Super Falcons will also miss their chance to qualify for the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup. Turning to volleyball, Brazil beat Tunisia in three straight sets in Katowice as Russia dismissed Egypt in Gdansk in a similar fashion at the ongoing World Men's Volleyball Championship in Poland. An equally winless Cameroon will challenge Argentina in Krakow today, Thursday. Moving on to rugby, South Africa and Kenya are among 12 countries set for the IRB Women's Sevens World Series qualifiers in Hong Kong, China next week. According to the International Rugby Board, four spots are up for grabs at the tournament. African champions South Africa are in Group A with China, France and Mexico. Kenya is in Group B with Argentina, Fiji and Japan, while Group C features Brazil, Hong Kong, Netherlands and Portugal. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United Nations World Health Organization is calling for a coordinated global response to combat the growing Ebola outbreak affecting parts of West Africa. That's it for this Thursday, September 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will have a very peaceful and healthy Thursday.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 1730 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.